Well, good morning, everybody, and it's good to be with you all. Let's look right away at the opening two verses of our reading from Matthew 26, verses 1 to 16. That's page 995, which we had read just a moment ago. Verses 1 and 2. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Well, already, as we see in verses 3 and 4, the evil plan was underway, headed by, well, the equivalent of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Caiaphas, the high priest, who had cooperated, crawled, and talked his way into a deal with the occupying Romans, who would keep their man in position for 18 long years. The plan with his fellow priests and elders was to arrest Jesus and have him killed, but to wait until the unpredictable, volatile atmosphere of Jerusalem was safely past the forthcoming Passover. Caiaphas didn't want any riots because he knew the Romans would not like that. Here now is Jesus, with 2 days to go to the Passover, telling his disciples of his forthcoming death. At that stage, they couldn't fathom what he was on about. For their leader to be crucified? But then are we surprised? Many today are equally slow. A member of the Cumberland Tennis Club, in Swiss Cottage, where I used to play, he put his confusion to me once, a few years ago. He was not a Christian believer, but he'd been to see the film, The Passion of Christ. And this was his query to me. If, he said, Jesus was to die for the sins of the world, why couldn't he die quietly in bed? No one had ever asked me that before. I replied to my friend, the death of the crucifixion, attended and applauded, even by decent members of society, including the religious top brass. Why, I said, that's the all-time demonstration of the depths of human wickedness, which, when presented with the purest being who has ever lived, can only shout, "Let him be crucified," and then laugh and jeer right into his face as they watch him slowly die. The cross says forever, "That's how ugly your sin is." But then I added, the cross also demonstrates the height of divine love, which, when confronted by a race of rebels that unanimously defies its maker, still persists in coming right among them in person to live and serve and heal and finally offer free forgiveness as he takes on himself in excruciating agony the penalty for the sins that would otherwise banish them into outer darkness. Well, that was part of our conversation at tennis. Back to the passage. Jesus is sitting, verse 6, you see it there, that table in Bethany, just up the hill from Jerusalem, in the home of his host, Simon the leper, so-called, presumably no longer a sufferer. Included among the guests there were Jesus' familiar friends, Mary and Martha, and their brother Lazarus, who had been raised from death only days earlier. We know it was with them that Jesus was eating because they're actually named in the account that John records of the same event in John chapter 12. Although John writes of Jesus arriving at Bethany 6 days, not two, before the Passover, there's no discrepancy. John doesn't state that the dinner was held immediately after Jesus' arrival in Bethany. It must have happened 4 days later. I say that for Bible students who may want to follow that up. So the dinner would have been Tuesday evening in Holy Week, with 2 clear days before Friday evening's Passover. Oh, Caiaphas may have wanted the trial to take place after Friday's evening Passover, when it was safely over. But Jesus was not going to allow anyone to interfere with the timing of his own divinely appointed hour, set, as it says in Revelation 13:8, set from the creation of the world. It would happen on Friday itself. And so Caiaphas' hand was going to be forced. That's the scene then, ladies and gentlemen, the dinner party. But what a fascinating contrast emerges in our passage now, with the secret plans not only of Caiaphas, but, verses 14 to 16, of a man, referred to here and again in the Gospels as one of the 12. That's what he's always called, namely Judas Iscariot. He has his own deal to make with the chief priests about his leader. Verse 15, what are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you? The contrast in our passage is between two characters, that of the woman, as she's called there in verse 7, who from John's Gospel we know to be Mary. She comes before Jesus, breaks open before him what must have been a priceless family heirloom, a box, a container of highly precious perfume, and she pours it over his head. John's account in John 12 adds that the feet of Jesus were anointed too, and Mary wipes them with her hair. Luke actually writes of a rather similar happening much earlier in the gospel story, in Luke 7 verse 36, when a notorious woman breaks into the house of a Pharisee, another Simon by name. There were plenty of Simons in the New Testament. And it was in the middle of dinner when this intruder, evidently in gratitude to Jesus, breaks the box of precious ointment, weepingly anointing his feet, wiping them with her hair, followed by an indignant complaint from the Pharisee host. But there's too much difference between the two events for them to have been the same. The restored sinner certainly wasn't Mary, who had always loved to sit at Jesus' feet and listen to him. Some wonder whether this woman might have been Mary Magdalene, but there's no evidence at all for that in the New Testament. The two anointings then only remind us that acts of loving gratitude can be almost exactly replicated on different occasions. Back again to Matthew 26 and the contrast there. There's only one thing that Mary and Judas have in common, and that is that they were both moving towards the same end, the death of Jesus. Otherwise, their characters were far apart. It was the preacher D.L. Moody of Chicago over 100 years ago who said, "Character is worth more than money. Character," he said, "is worth more than anything else in the whole world." Well, here are two characters. We could entitle this passage, "Our Characters Divide at the Cross." Let's look further at the contrast between these two characters. First, of course, the two actions. One was of overflowing extravagance, the other of shabby betrayal. Mary's action indeed was so lavish that the disciples present spoke up. "Such waste," they said, "when the ointment could have been sold and the proceeds given to charity." It's John's account in chapter 12 that makes it clear that the complaints began with the money-conscious Judas. It's in the Greek text of John's Gospel that the value of the perfume is said to have been above the sum of 300 pence, or denarii, that is, a year's wages. To put that in context, well, at the feeding of the 5,000, the disciple Philip says to Jesus that 200 denarii wouldn't be enough to feed such a crowd. So Mary's gesture of 300 would probably have fed the lot of those 5,000 people. As for Judas, his words exhibit his character. What will you give me if I hand him over to you? Here's the bargaining betrayer. The chief priests count out 30 pieces of silver for Judas. You can try Googling that amount in today's currency to find out what its value is. It's quite hard, actually. The safest estimate is to ask yourself what half a year's average wage might amount to. 30 pieces of silver receives a mention in the prophecies of both Jeremiah and Zechariah, which has always fascinated those who have a compelling interest in Old Testament prophecy. Though there is perhaps more significance in Exodus 21:32. Such a sum was said there to be the price of a slave. Well, maybe we apply that to Jesus. It's possible that the chief priests had but a slave's value in mind when they weighed out the silver to Judas. The contrast between the two actions, I think it's about the most pronounced in the whole Bible. Overflowing extravagance against shabby betrayal. But can we take up a second part of the contrast? Let me call it the two agendas. Mary and Judas. What drove them each? On the part of Mary, it is obvious. Her action was prompted by open and grateful devotion. In the case of Judas, there's always been a degree of, well, speculation. Was he disappointed that Jesus was apparently not going to challenge the might of Rome and defy its authorities in the style of the Jewish zealots whose party had been in existence ever since the 2nd century BC at the time of intensive Greek opposition? Possibly. What makes me hesitate is that one of the other 12 disciples, who was called Simon, not Simon Peter, was known as Simon the Zealot. So they did have a man of zealot outlook, at least among the 12, yet one who could stay loyal to Jesus in spite of his personal views. Thus it ought to have been possible for Judas also to stay loyal. I suspect that only one thing essentially drove him, and it could be described as what Jesus called mammon, the love of money. Excuse me while I cough. You poor people sharing in the recording of this, it's all right, I've had a cough. But I remember it happened once to an American preacher, and he was finally heard to gasp out, "I ain't finished yet, but I quit." Well, I am not quitting just yet. Mary here, driven by open devotion. Judas, driven by secret avarice. Mary had sat at Jesus' feet, entranced by his teaching. She'd seen her brother Lazarus raised. Imagine that. And supper now with Jesus Christ. Imagine that. Why, it gave her an opportunity to do something for him. Maybe Jesus saw in that breaking of the alabaster container a picture of his own body, soon to be broken at the cross. What he actually said was that though the disciples always had the poor around them who could do with the money, he said, "You don't always have me. Here comes the water. Thank you." And then he goes on, verse 12, to interpret Mary's action as, look at it, a beautiful thing that she's done. "He did it, as he put it, to prepare me for burial." Well, that word perfume in verse 7, in the original Greek text, is the word myron, myrrh. Myrrh was always used for burials. Mary had somehow lighted on what the rest of the disciples failed to comprehend, that Jesus was going to die soon and be buried. And what about Judas? Earlier in the story, Jesus had predicted in John 6, verse 70, Have I not chosen you, the 12, yet one of you is a devil? It seems that Judas, the treasurer, the bursar of the group, who held a money bag for them all, has somehow become addicted to the very money he was handling. Or it has happened before, and it'll happen again. You get Achan, in the book of Joshua, burying illicit treasure for himself after the victory at Jericho. Or Saul, who disobediently saved up spoil from the Amalekites. Or you get Elisha's servant Gehazi, who cashed in on the healing of Naaman the Syrian. Ananias and Sapphira, who held back part of their contribution to the New Testament church, pretending that it was all. Simon, the ex-sorcerer in Acts 8, who thought he could buy spiritual power with money. Does it happen today? Oh, yes, it does. The prosperity gospel, as it's come to be called, is rampant today in its utterly false belief that a real believer can expect promotion, cash, perfect health, a second car, whatever. To quote from a song from Garth Hewitt, who was with us here at Christchurch only a few weeks ago, his song, "I see those TV preachers, holy get-you-rich-quick teachers, like pre-digested TV dinners, offer instant salvation packs for sinners. Put your hand on the TV screen, makes God look like a slot machine. Is this really what you meant by your costly blood-bought covenant?" Garth Hewitt. You can make the prosperity gospel look pretty good if you put certain selected scriptures together, but it's a doomed message that only brings disillusionment in its wake. It's related to covetousness. It was actually the 16th century missionary churchman Francis Xavier who said that covetousness is always a secret vice. No one ever admits to it. He declared that in all his years of speaking with penitent people, not a single one ever confessed to him the sin of covetousness. It's secret. And Judas was a secret operator. When Jesus at the Last Supper said, "One of you will betray me," all the disciples asked anxiously, "Is it me?" They didn't know about Judas. They never pointed at him and said, "Oh, he's the one. We know all about him." Not at all. Mary and Judas. In one, the action of extravagance. In the other, the action of shabby betrayal. In one, the agenda of open devotion. In the other, the agenda of secret avarice. I detect a last area of contrast between what I call the two legacies. Down the ages, we've been left with the recall of what we could call the two kisses. One from a devoted follower embracing her master's feet, the other from what perhaps would be the most painful experience for Jesus than all this spitting into his face that he would receive the next day. Or in a few days' time, here was the treacherous kiss from one of his own, a kiss providing the gateway to the torches and the lanterns and pathetic swords of his enemies, along with the futile spears of the accompanying soldiery. Both Mary of Bethany and Judas Iscariot, they get into the Bible, but with such contrasting ends, two different legacies. For her part, Mary had broken her box of ointment as a memorial to her master, only for him to turn her action into a memorial about her. That, he promised, would be remembered forever around the world. I don't like to speak of Judas's legacy. Some wonder, perhaps, was it unfair that Jesus described him as a son of destruction or perdition in his prayer of John chapter 17. But no, Judas had every chance. At the end, he didn't say, "Well, I've been unfairly treated. It's all been terrible for me." He said, "I have betrayed innocent blood." He knew. God help us, as we learn today from the contrast between the two actions, agendas, and legacies of these two people we've been considering this morning. We come to Holy Week in a few days' time. Next Sunday, we hear of Christ riding into Jerusalem with the crowd shouting Hallelujah. The crucifixion lay ahead the following Friday. Jesus wept that Palm Sunday, not for himself, but for them all, as he thought of Jerusalem's future. Jesus weeping. Earlier he'd wept at the tomb of Lazarus, who, when raised from the dead, was actually present as a fellow guest at Simon's dinner party. I want to take Mary's side. I don't want to make Jesus weep, and nor do you. His love deserves better. As I said to that tennis friend of mine, the cross shows the depth of human sin, but it also shows the height of divine love. Let's get ready for Holy Week. As I close, Lazarus' presence at dinner that night reminds me of words from one of the most powerful evangelists that God ever gave the world, George Whitefield. Preaching 250 years ago at St. Helen's Church in Bishopsgate, London, he was speaking of Christ when he said, "The Jews, when he only shed a tear at poor Lazarus' funeral, said, 'Behold how he loved him.' How much more justly may we cry out, 'Behold how he loved us,' when he shed not only a tear, but his own most precious blood for us." Holy Week is coming. Let us prepare for it well every day.